This is Stealing Home. I'm David Temple. In the radio industry, we call this ambient sound. It's like the B-roll in video. Or I guess the B-roll is like ambient sound, since recorded sound came first. Anyway, radio people play this to give the listener a sense of place. In this case, the place is Wrigley Field. You are hearing my footsteps, along with my wife's footsteps, and the footsteps of about 30 other people who are attending a tour of Wrigley. Tours are a great way to get a crash course on something. Want to see an old Navy ship? Take a tour. Feel like riding on a bus while seeing the most identifiable parts of a city? Tour. And if you want the Cliff's Notes on the history of a ballpark, a tour is a way to go. It may sound like I'm poking fun, but I was generally interested in seeing my Wrigley tour. I'd never been before, and I knew there was a lot of history I hadn't known about. But what I experienced is something way more than a generic look at that type of ballpark stroll. And I think it had a lot to do with my tour guide. Wrigley tour guides get a little bit of a head start. There's so much to talk about, after all. When I toured Target Field, there was a lot of talk about construction. What was made out of what, why something was designed that way, etc. It's no dig on them, the thing had just been built. Wrigley tours offer a slight bit of that, but it was more like a walking history lesson. Hey, look at that, now sit down, and I'm going to tell you some stuff. A tour is a very shared experience. You and the other attendees are in it together. But when the tour guide is not only bestowing knowledge, but also taking everything in with you, even though it could be their 4,000th time doing it, it makes it more special. That's what my tour guide, Alex Roberts, did.
All right, looks like we're all out here. Welcome again to Wrigley Field. Looks like we had chose a really good time to go out there onto the field. I, of course, planned that. The two batters who were up there that you got to see, number 9 in the red, was David DeJesus, our center fielder, and the guy with that amazing head of hair, number 44, Anthony Rizzo. So they were both taken back.
Collecting
balls.
Over to the left, actually, the light
blue shirt. That's just the margin, which was yesterday. So as you can see, kind of a cool lot of stuff going on. Obviously, there's a game coming up later today, so they're getting ready, getting warmed up. Lots of stuff going on here. Wrigley Field's a really cool place, even when there's no one here. It's a special place, a place I'm sure a lot of you guys know. It's very, very old. We were built in 1914, the only park older than us that's still functioning and still has Major League Baseball. It's Fenway Park, built 1912.
I wish I could play the whole thing for you. Alex has an awesome job, and he certainly appears to know it. He takes his responsibilities seriously, but he understands just how cool his office is. The Cubs ended up beating the Pirates that afternoon, but, and I know this is totally cliche, I was the real winner that day. Because I finally got to experience my favorite game in one of the oldest stadiums in baseball, in a city with over a century of baseball history. It shouldn't have taken me this long to make my baseball pilgrimage to Chicago, but late was certainly better than never.
Really changed baseball. Before then, it was known as a dead ball era. They only played with two balls. Now we play with about 10 to 12 dozen balls every game. A few years later, after we revolutionized that, we decided to re-revolutionize it out these bleachers.
From the Memorial Studios of Tinker, Evers, and Chance, this is Stealing Home. I'm your host, David Temple. It's all about the Windy City today, and some of the things that make it such a great baseball town. I'll talk more with Alex Roberts about his life as a Wrigley tour guide and just how lucky we both think he is. Then, in the interest of fairness, I talked to two White Sox fans, one who recently moved to Chicago and another who never actually lived there. And then I tip my cap to one of the most famous men in Chicago baseball with the MVP of my heart. It's all coming up on Stealing Home. Let's play ball. Thank you. Imagine being a tour guide at a major league ballpark and spending about 90 minutes showing people around. Then at the end, when people are shaking your hand and thanking you for doing a great job, a weirdo who is recording the whole thing asks you for your email address so he can interview you for a podcast you'd never heard of. That's what happened to Alex Roberts. I was the weirdo, obviously, but he was nice enough to accept my invitation. We actually got in touch while he was on vacation with his family in California, but he was gracious enough to talk to me about how he approaches his very interesting job. Alex, thanks for joining me on Stealing Home.
Okay, great. Thanks. I'm really happy to be here.
So I was hoping that before we get started, you could kind of tell us how you came to be a tour guide for the Chicago Cubs.
Yeah, totally. Came about just a few months ago. I think it was in February or March. I've been working a few different part-time jobs and was obviously looking for a little more work, and actually just came upon the listing for the job at Indeed.com. I didn't even see it on the actual Cubs job site, and it was just, I think the full term, full name of the job was part-time tour guide associate, I think was the name. Obviously, sounded like kind of a thing. I had no idea if I was qualified to do it or not, but just sounded like kind of a dream job. So I applied. A few weeks later, got the email from the coordinator, our coordinator Evan Hill, who's like a really, really cool guy. It was kind of a cool process. He had us send in videos, just kind of us talking about what we were excited to do, why we wanted the job, and then posted on either, you know, YouTube or Vimeo or something. I put mine on Vimeo. And then from there, I just kind of, I guess mine was good enough. Heard back from him, had a just kind of a regular interview and stuff, and then a few of us ended up going to the orientation at the beginning of April, meeting each other, and then just kind of started from there. So I've been given tours since the, I think, the first or second week of April.
What kind of stuff did you put on that video?
Mine was pretty, it was kind of just a small, you know, self-interview sitting in front of a camera. Mine was pretty rehearsed. I came up with just sort of three to four minutes of just kind of me talking about my background. I'm pretty new to the Chicago area. I moved there at the fall of 2011. Sorry, I think a car just drove by me. Moved to Chicago in the fall of 2011. And kind of from there, it was, you know, I'm from New Mexico originally, so no real, you know, Major League Baseball teams or anything. So just living so close to the Cubs, living so close to Wrigley Field was just such an immediately such an exciting thing. Probably that was just by far the coolest thing about living there. So just starting with the 2012 season, it was kind of funny because they were, you know, they weren't very good that year, and they're still, you know, rebuilding, as we call it. But it was just a joy to get to go to those games and get to watch them play. I ended up getting to like 12 games during the 2012 season, just having a real blast and just kind of turning that into my passion. And so I just kind of talked about that, talked about how much I love Wrigley Field. I'm also a filmmaker and an animator, so I just put some cutesy little intertitles, which might have helped out. I made a kind of a title that said Wrigley Field Tour Guide, and I made a little blue wind flag for Wrigley and had that like flying. So that was kind of fun. So yeah, it was a pretty simple video, but just a way to let them know that I was really excited for the job and that, you know, Wrigley Field and the Cubs mean a lot to me.
Did you grow up a baseball fan? Like, did you have any allegiance to any specific team before the Cubs?
Yeah, I did actually. I grew up, my folks are all from back east, so I actually grew up a Boston Red Sox guy. And it was kind of funny. I make the joke that, you know, who was running to get to Chicago quicker, myself or Theo Epstein, because I moved there the same. I moved there to, you know, a week or two before he announced that he was the president of baseball management there. And it just kind of felt like a fun time, a really cool time to kind of start becoming a Cubs fan for me personally. Coming off a really bad season in 2011, but coming in at a time when it felt like, as difficult as the baseball side of things might be, that it's that there was a lot of improvements that we were going to see in the next few years, which I think already we're starting to see that with some of the young guys coming up, some Arjen, Rizzo, and guys like that. So yeah, that was I was originally kind of as a Red Sox fan growing up. I guess I decided they were winning too much, so I just had to go find another long-suffering fan base to join.
Now, even though you're a baseball fan, one of the things that I noticed when I went on your tour was just how much you knew about Wrigley Field and the Cubs in general, and you weren't reading from any notes or anything like that. It was all, it seemed kind of extemporaneous, you know, off the top of your head. How did you get to know that much stuff in really a short period of time?
Yeah, it's kind of funny. It was a lot. I think most of the stuff I do on the tour was stuff that we were just kind of given with the notes when we started out. When we first started, we were emailed a 30 to 40 page booklet, just basically kind of told, you know, no pressure, but learn all of this. and it was really fun. It was just kind of stuff I was excited to learn about anyway, I think. My girlfriend and a lot of other people always make fun of me how I always have like 6 or 7 Wikipedia pages up at once on my computer at all times, just, you know, trying to remember when Ernie Banks' 500th home run was, or, you know, all these other things that I keep wanting to memorize and forgetting to. So in a lot of ways, the job was just a perfect excuse for me to get to memorize this stuff anyway. And I think a lot of this stuff, I don't know if there's too many things that I've added myself to the stuff I talked about on my tours, but a lot of it just comes from, you know, learning something about Wrigley Field and wanting to know more about it. I think that was especially true for me. One of the flags that flies over the roof there is says Hack on one side, 191 on the other for Hack Wilson, and that's for the 191 RBIs he hit in the 1930 season. And from there, you know, that was just kind of the information we were given in our tour notes. But from there, you know, that immediately just kind of struck me as a fascinating narrative. Like, why does nobody know about this? Why is that just kind of the least known kind of major record in baseball that stood for, you know, 70 to 80 years? And I ended up, you know, kind of researching it, finding out just what a fascinating kind of, you know, sad, tragic character Hack Wilson was. Rivaled Babe Ruth for 4 or 5 years there, and then his drinking and being such a kind of pugnacious guy just kind of ended up derailing his entire life. So I try to bring that in. Obviously, you know, you can't get too dark with different tour groups, but just stuff like that. I think in general, I'm always, just for me personally, this is something I just absolutely love to do, and I really, really love to learn about. And I've kind of been, you know, I graduated from school 3 years ago and have kind of been considering going back to school for a long time. And in a way, this is like my opportunity to just go back to school and learn about baseball, which is the coolest.
Do you feel like you're in kind of a special position because you're in charge of, in a lot of cases, I imagine most of the people who take the tour are going to Wrigley Field for the first time or one of the first few times. You're kind of in a special position where you get to introduce them to one of the mainstays of baseball. You know, I've taken a ballpark tour here in Minneapolis at Target Field, and it was very informative and it was very good, but, you know, it was a brand new park. That park, Wrigley, has so much history involved in it. Does that ring with you every now and then when you're telling people about all the things that happened in that ballpark?
Oh, yeah. No, I think that's something that is kind of present with me just kind of every moment I'm there, I think. you know, it is kind of a dream job, and it is kind of an unbelievable privilege to be able to say that I work at that ballpark, and, you know, I go to work and I get to see Wrigley Field every day. It's something that's always in the back of my mind, and maybe to a large extent why I'm always, you know, trying to make sure that I know as much as I can. I think, there's always a tour, you know, almost every tour we have, you'll end up having people there who are kind of at a loss for words, or, you know, I think last week we had a woman that was her 60th birthday and all she wanted to do was go to Wrigley Field. She had never been there before. And just kind of started crying while we were walking around. It was just really amazing. And I think that's just, to me, it just drives home the fact that I need to do a really good job at it. And that it's not, and it's easy for me to do just because it's not just a job to me. It's obviously kind of the coolest job I've ever had. Something I just always want to excel at. And I think that, yeah, people come in, I think they expect a lot. I know a lot of people compare it. I've had people come up and compare it to me favorably, which is nice, to the, you know, the tours at Fenway, tours at all the other ballparks. So that's just kind of something that's definitely in my mind all the time, is making sure that if I'm talking about something, I know what I'm talking about, trying to connect it to the history that's there and connecting it to what's there now. And I think people have responded well to that so far, at least, which is really nice.
Alex, you've mentioned a lot of things that that you really like about your job, and it seems that you really care about it, not just in this interview, but from the interactions that you that I've had with you as a tour guide. But I have to ask, what do you think is your favorite part about being a Wrigley Field tour guide?
That's pretty tough. Gosh, I think just in general, it's when you can so clearly see people kind of connecting to what you're saying, and where they are. I think that's kind of the cool thing about being a tour guide compared to other kind of performances or anything else like that, is that the setting is obviously such a central part to what I'm saying. It wouldn't really mean much if I'm just talking about the history of the park, if I'm on the street or something. And I think that's really the coolest thing for me, is when there are people who are really appreciative, who kind of understand where they are, and then I'm able to just drive that home that much more to them. You know, I think people go to Wrigley Field. I think the reason people take the tour is because they know there's something there to see. They know that it's a ballpark that now we're over 99 years old, and it'll be there for a long, long time. We'll be 100 next year, and I'm sure we'll be going on for the next 100 years or more. But I think people go there, and they know there's something special there, but they might not really be as well-versed, obviously, as I am, but maybe as well as locals or longtime Cubs fans are, to just how many special things have happened in that park, and just all the World Series that have been played there, all the great players that have gone through that clubhouse, and just all the love that has been kind of shown towards the team and the different people who have played there throughout the years. I think that's, to me, something that's always special going to a game, is that even when, you know, the Cubs are having a rough stretch right now, that you're still going to find tens of thousands of people who are out there cheering like it's a World Series game. That was actually one of the cool things. I went to the very last game last year in October of 2012, and there was a guy standing in the upper decks with us with a big sign that said, "This is my World Series Game 7. When we were just hoping to beat the Astros so we didn't get 102 losses on the year. But, I think in general for me, it's when people, are there and are already excited enough to be there. But when I'm able to speak well, when I'm able to bring my information across in a way that makes them just have that much more of a respect and excitement for being there, is really, for me, the coolest part. And I think it's happened more often than not for me, which is a really nice sign. I think most of my tours, people really, really, you see people nodding their heads when I tell them something particularly weird or special, or kind of realizing, oh yeah, like I didn't realize that about the scoreboard or the way the field is lined up or something like that. That's always just a really special thing to me and something that's very cool.
Well, I was skeptical at first, but I have to recommend, if anybody's in Chicago, to take a Wrigley Field tour. And if they get Alex Roberts as a tour guide, they're certainly in for a treat. Alex Roberts is a part-time tour guide for the Chicago Cubs. You can follow him on Twitter at Rock and Roll Martian. That's ROQN Roll Martian. Or you can visit his website, byalexroberts.wordpress.com. Alex, thanks so much for joining me.
Hey, thank you so much, Dave. It's been a pleasure.
With all this Cubs talk, I knew it wouldn't be fair if I didn't talk to some White Sox fans. So I called up my friend Tom Flynn. He lives here in the Twin Cities. We talked about coming into White Sox fandom during some really terrible years and following the team from afar before, you know, the internet. Tom, thanks for joining me on Stealing Home.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Now, I know you as a White Sox fan, but if I recall correctly, you're not actually from the Chicago area originally. Can you give us a little background on how you came to follow the White Sox?
Sure. I grew up in Denver, pre-MLB Denver, but my mom is from a town about 80 miles from Chicago. And as a kid, we would drive back there every summer, and my grandfather would take us to White Sox games. So they were the first team I ever saw live as far as MLB is concerned. And my grandpa was a pretty hardcore fan. So he was the type that refused to go to Wrigley. He said, you know, if you want to go to Wrigley, ask your uncles. And so I think I kind of wanted to please grandpa, and I stayed true to the White Sox.
And that was in old Comiskey Park. Comiskey was the first stadium I visited. I grew up in Wisconsin, so I'd been to County, where the Brewers play, but Comiskey was the first quote unquote out of town park that I had ever visited. And I remember it was a real different feel. This was back in, geez, early high school, so I don't remember it as well. I was hoping you could tell us a little bit the things you remember about that park, because it was certainly unique.
Sure. Well, you know, my experience with baseball was Mile High Stadium in Denver, watching minor league baseball, you know, and that's a stadium of, at the time, you know, 65, 70,000 people, and they would draw about 10,000 for a good, maybe 15 for a good Denver Bears game. But then going to Chicago, it was a big deal because I would see maybe one game a year. And, you know, I think like every kid, the first thing I remember is just how green it was inside. But also the great arched windows that surrounded the ballpark, and you could it created really interesting light. I remember that. And it was one of those old ballparks that also had field boxes. The seats down low were separated by pipes, you know, like railings around each box. And I just remember how tidy it looked. And I was just so amazed. I was talking to a Sox fan a couple weeks ago about my memories of it being this enormous place, but it was actually a pretty compact place. It had big field dimensions, but for the size of the park it was, you know, it was pretty cozy.
So as a kid growing up, I know that, and you know, and I fell into that trap too, where with sports, especially it seemed like for me, at least football and basketball, you just want to be a fan of the team that's winning. You know, you want to be a fan of the winning team. As a White Sox fan, and props to you for sticking with them for that long of a drought. You know, to a kid, that's not an easy thing to do. Did you find other things to take gratitude in during those losing seasons? Were there things that you looked forward to, even though you knew the team maybe wasn't that good?
Definitely. I mean, as a White Sox fan living in Denver, it was very rare to ever see them on TV. You know, I mean, we would stay up to watch sports on the local news, just hoping that there would be a highlight. They rarely played on the Saturday game of the week, which is the only televised baseball we got. So I pretty much followed them through the newspapers. And then my grandparents would occasionally send newspapers and, you know, like the Sunday magazines with the big profiles and things like that. But because of that, and because the White Sox weren't very good, my brother and I became fans of baseball generally. You know, I mean, I always pulled for the White Sox, but we devoured the newspaper and followed every team and had our favorite players. And, you know, by July, usually you were following another team pretty closely because the White Sox were double digits out of first place, you know, so. But there was always the trip to Chicago to look forward to and actually seeing a game, you know, that was huge. So I've always kind of equated the White Sox with like vacation almost, you know, where it's a big deal to get to see them live.
Now with that big drought, I mean, a lot of attention was paid to the Red Sox when they finally overcame, you know, their big long drought. And, you know, if God in his infinite wisdom decides to ever give the Cubs, you know, a good enough team to win the World Series, that'll certainly be a huge story. But the White Sox were kind of an underreported. I remember in 2005, that's when I really realized, oh, yeah, the White Sox haven't won anything, like, in a long time. You know, a few divisions here and there. So that must have been, like, I mean, what was that like just to have that vindication, you know, finally in 2005?
Well, it was surreal because as a White Sox fan, I really did not expect to ever see the Sox in a World Series, period, let alone win it. And so 2005 rolled around and they jumped out of the gates on fire that year. And they were the best team in baseball pretty much through July. And then they really started to buckle in August and September and just won it by the skin of their teeth at the end of the season, fighting off a surge from the Indians. Mm-hmm. And so by the time the regular season ended, you were just like thrilled that they made the postseason. But, you know, I had been down that road three times in my life. Mm-hmm. And seeing them get eliminated in the first round. So I didn't want to get my hopes up, you know, and especially right. after this almost late season collapse. And then they just got on a tear and had incredible pitching. And you mentioned the Red Sox. And ironically, I was living in Portland, Maine in 2005. I moved there in 2000. So I experienced that whole Red Sox World Series the year before from basically the belly of the beast in northern New England. And then the following year went through the same thing with the White Sox, but I was literally the only White Sox fan I knew. And it was kind of crazy, you know, and my wife watched the games with me, but she's a Twins fan. So
now even though I know you haven't really spent much time in Chicago, I have to ask you, there's a weird vibe, at least that I've picked up between White Sox fans and Cubs fans. It's not I guess you'd call it a rivalry. It's not a rivalry like you'd think Red Sox Yankees or something like that. But there's still something. At the beginning, is it purely like territorial, north side versus south side, or do you just pick your team and roll with it? And then once you've latched onto that team, you know, how do you interact with Cubs fans?
Well, it's interesting for me because my experience is, you know, my extended family lives outside of the cities. But I have uncles and cousins who are huge Cubs fans. And so it's not a geographical thing for them or for us. But I have spent quite a bit of time in Chicago. I've just never lived there. And my experience with the rivalry is that it is pretty friendly. It's almost like sibling rivalry. But it can get a little ugly at crosstown series when there's a lot of drinking involved and people getting, blowing it out of proportion. But my experience with it has always been mostly, I would say, almost completely friendly.
So it's more of a headlock and a noogie kind of rivalry than a full-on fisticuffs rivalry.
In my experience, yeah. Except, like I said, at crosstown series, the Crosstown Series game I went to, I've only been to one, but, you know, I saw quite a bit of fighting and ugliness in the crowd.
Okay, well, we've talked about the past. I want to end off on the future of the White Sox. Because I just love talking baseball. They're not doing so hot right now, which is okay. I mean, that happens. But what do you see in the kind of near future for this team and maybe a little bit down the road?
Well, it's really hard to say. I mean, as bad as things are going right now, you have to anticipate that there's going to be a sell-off or they're going to try to make some trades. The problem is they're just not, they're not stocked with a lot of pieces other teams are really going to jump at. So all I really know is that we're right at the end of Paul Konerko's career, which kind of breaks my heart, especially with Burley leaving. I mean, those two are the kind of heroes of my adult fanhood, you know? So I feel like it's definitely the end of an era. We've got huge question marks all around the field at third base, at catcher. We don't have a terribly deep farm system. We've got some some young talent, I think, that can help us, but not at the positions that we most need the help. I hope they keep Chris Sale around. I think that gives you some hope for the future that you can establish a rotation around that guy. But really all I see are question marks. I just know that there's going to be major change and probably in the next 12 months so or less.
Tom Flynn is the proprietor of the blog mightyflynn.tumblr.com. It's really great. Please go check it out. It's wonderful. And you can follow him on Twitter at @mighty_Flynn. Tom, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me. Go, go Sox.
Switching gears a little bit, I talked to C. Angie. She's an MLB writer for SBNation.com. She's a somewhat recent transplant to the city of Chicago. She's taken on the White Sox as her hometown team, so we talked a little bit about that and her observations as a new fan in a city steeped in baseball history. C., thanks for joining me on Stealing Home.
Hey, David. Thanks for having me.
Now, I know you're not originally from Chicago. You made your way there a few years back. Can you tell us about how you made your way to Chicago and how you kind of immersed yourself in the baseball culture once you got there?
Well, I moved to Chicago in 2008. I had been living in Louisville, Kentucky for, I think, around 6 years. I went to undergrad there and fell in love and stayed for a little longer than I expected to. But I ended up moving to Chicago in 2008 for graduate school. And I just wanted to, I think the biggest thing that I wanted to do when I moved here was just to experience life in a big city. I had never really done that before. My family had moved around a ton. I've lived in a lot of different places, but mainly small towns, lots of southern cities, and definitely never anything like Chicago. So the ability to have so many different things at my fingertips as far as museums and sports and restaurants and even just parks and bookstores and everything. I just sort of just dove into the culture here head first, and I'm still trying to do as much as I can and see as much as I can, but I fell in love with baseball here really easily. And that was a combination of going to Cubs games and going to White Sox games. But, you know, in 2008 and 2009, those were still seasons that it was really difficult to get Cubs tickets. And I was also a broke grad student, so I certainly couldn't afford a lot of Cubs games because they were a lot more expensive then. So I have a good friend who's a White Sox fan whose family had season tickets, and it just became really natural to spend a lot of time on the South Side at that ballpark.
Now, coming from smaller towns, like you said, you I'm sure you've seen, you know, games in, you know, either minor league stadiums or you know, high school teams or something like that. And I know that you've visited other major league parks, but what was it like to kind of have a home base, a place that you could know you could go and see a major league game on a fairly regular basis?
Yeah, it's really the first place that I've lived that I've had that opportunity. We lived close to bigger cities. Like, I spent some time going to games in St. Louis when I was in high school. Same thing with Cleveland. My family's originally from Southern Ohio, so I went to a lot of Reds games growing up. But I never had the ability where I could just check a schedule and say, this is the day I'm going to go to a game. Whereas before, there were just so many logistics involved in planning it. So it's been kind of nice. I sort of had the same thing when I lived in Louisville. I had season tickets for their minor league team, and I spent a lot of time at the park there. And I think that's one of the reasons that I sort of became such a big White Sox fan. It's sort of the same experience. Of course, it's a major league park and it's a major league team, but the attendance tends to be pretty low and you sort of have your run of the place. And it feels a lot more intimate than a lot of the other major league parks that I've been to in that respect. And then when you go there regularly, you start to learn the ins and outs of the ballpark, and I don't know. I think I just sort of settled on it.
I was curious about that because when you experience a stadium for the first time, there's a lot of things that you think about because it's your first time there or even your second, maybe your third time there. But as you go more often, you start to pick up on other things, the way the fans behave, the way the game is presented. What are some of the first things you noticed as kind of a reoccurring trend at a White Sox game?
You know, I don't even really remember my first experiences at the ballpark. I had actually been there a couple times before I moved to Chicago. And even once I started going regularly, I don't remember thinking it was anything special. And even today, I don't know that I really think it's anything spectacular. I certainly wouldn't say it's, you know, in the upper echelon of ballparks or anything like that. But it certainly has a lot of charm to it. And I think there just comes a time where you go to a park so often that you start to pick up on the little nuances of the park and start to realize that, you know, you really understand how that park operates, because they all operate so different, even if it's a small thing like knowing on which screen to look for the pitch count, or knowing where they'll flash the official scoring of different plays. So I don't know. I think it's one of those things that you eventually just find comfort in a ballpark, and it becomes a lot more familiar than you'd ever imagine that it would. But every time I walk around there, especially if I'm taking someone for their first time, I feel a little bit like a tour guide, and I've sort of become pretty proud of the ballpark experience there, because I've had really nothing but good things to say about it. And I think the overall consensus is that a lot of people agree that it's a very underrated park that sort of has that stigma of being a scary park on the south side of Chicago. But once people are inside the confines of it, they think it's pretty swell.
Now, not being a native Chicagoan, I imagine that experiencing Chicago fans, either for the Cubs or the White Sox, is sort of a new experience. Is there, what are the differences that you noticed when you started regularly going to White Sox games, that the things that the fans would do, or ways they would act?
You know, I hate to get so wrapped up in the difference between Cubs fans and White Sox fans, because I think it's sort of silly in a lot of regards. I guess they're natural rivals because they're in the same city. But, you know, you have your fringe fans that sort of really start to get into the north side, south side sort of battles. But for the most part, I think people who are rational and sensible can just say, hey, we have two ballparks in the city, why don't we try and enjoy both of them? And I think that's what a lot of people end up doing. As far as the south side, though, like I said, the attendance is pretty low, and it continues to drop a little bit. And so if you go to a weeknight game, it's a pretty empty ballpark. You know, some people see a big problem with that. Obviously, there are some revenue implications of that eventually if, you know, attendance gets down too low. But from the fan perspective, it's sort of awesome. You know, you can go to a Monday or Tuesday night game, grab a ticket right behind home plate, you know, 20 rows behind the plate for $15, $20. And then you never have to wait in line for a bathroom, for a beer vendor, to get your helmet nachos, whatever it is that you want to do. You know, it, like I said, it's sort of like a minor league park in that respect, because, you know, you're watching a major league caliber team play sometimes, not necessarily this year, but you just have sort of a small microcosm going on within there that you don't have at some of these parks that are continuing out.
I'm going to ask you to put on your analyst hat for a minute, okay, because I want to talk to you about that rebuilding process, because it seems the writing's on the wall, it seems, for that team. They have a few chips, you know, mainly in Chris Sale, who's really just mowing down the competition right now. Paul Konerko is on his way out, whether by hook or by crook. He's not going to be on that team very much longer. They have a lot of holes to fill, is what I'm getting at. What do you think would be the good approach to rebuilding that team and helping them get competitive, not necessarily even next year, but within the next, you know, 2 or 3 years?
I think there are a lot of different ways that they can go with making the team better long-term. Obviously, it's funny, though, because you mentioned Chris Sale as being their most tradable asset. And, you know, I would certainly agree with that. But, you know, they also signed him to an incredibly team-friendly 5-year, $32.5 million deal. And, you know, I don't think that they see him as someone that they're willing to trade. I think that he's sort of going to be the foundation for which they build the team around. So if he got traded at the deadline, I think it would be a huge surprise. So I sort of don't really consider Chris Sale one of their tradable assets. But what they do have is they do have Alex Rios, who has had an incredible season so far. They also have, Alejandro Diaz may be a good trade chip for them too. He's played pretty well this season. He'd be a cheap get for a different team. They have a couple of different ways that they can go, but the things that they really have to focus on are developing minor league talent. which is something that they've never really done, especially under Kenny Williams. You know, they've been more willing to trade those players than they have to develop them. And they're to the point now where they can't really spend any more money on the free agents in the offseason. So I think it's just going to be a matter of getting really strategic, you know, trusting your young talent, figuring out what pieces you think you can do without, and really trying to rebuild. But it's going to be a long process for them. They don't really have the minor league depth that's sitting there ready to come up and fill in some of these gaps. And, you know, that's been incredibly obvious this season as players like Gordon Beckham have been injured.
But luckily for them, they are in, I'd still probably consider it the weakest division in the AL Central. How long do you think they're until they're competitive again, assuming they make at least most of the right moves?
Well, you know, the moves for them now, you know, in the current state of the team have to be offensive moves. And, you know, that's sort of something that they've struggled with in the minors as well, though. They have some talented outfielding prospects. They really are, the infield is going to be a huge weakness for them for a while. The pitching seems pretty much set. You know, they have not been able to develop a lot of major league talent as far as offensive players, but they've been good with pitching. So, and I don't really see the pitching changing that much, you know. Danks is having a good season coming back from injury. Jake Peavy's dealing with a little bit of injury. But, you know, you have Sale, you have Axelrod, and you have Quintana, who have all basically, you know, come up. They sort of didn't know what they were going to do with any of them. They kind of shuffled them through the bullpen, and they've shown that they're able to join the rotation. And when you have that sort of flexibility with pitching, I think it's certainly a good thing. But, I mean, this season they're terrible in offense. They're pretty much the worst offense in the majors, along with the Marlins. And that's going to take a really long time to fix.
Well, it'll certainly be interesting for the next few years, especially with such an aggressive front office. And I look forward to reading your analysis on their performance and the performance of all the other teams around baseball. C. Angie is a writer for the MLB side of SB Nation. You can find that at sbnation.com/MLB. You can follow her on Twitter at C. Angie, C-E-E-A-N-G-I, and visit her personal baseball site at baseballpros.com. C, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much, David.
We end every episode by taking a look at someone who, for actions on the field or off, deserve a little love. It's the MVP of my heart. Since I'd never been to Wrigley, I decided to splurge on good seats for my first visit. My wife and I sat behind home plate, about 20 rows up. The view was great. The man sitting in front of me must have been some sort of architect or something, because toward the end of the game, he produced a sketch pad and started drawing the left field side of the stadium. I was looking over his shoulder, checking his work and comparing it to the actual surroundings, and that's when I saw it. I couldn't imagine how it had slipped my mind to look for it before. There it was, left field line, about halfway up the wall that rises at an angle, the Bartman seat. I couldn't pinpoint the exact seat, but I knew it was there. I knew that somewhere over there in Section 4, 10 years ago, something happened that would change the lives of one man, one player, and an already tortured fan base. I must have stared at that section for 15 minutes. Baseball is an obsessive game by nature, but fans tend to further that by latching on to specific things. For me, it's the 1975 Reds, the swing of Yoenis Céspedes, the career of Rondell White, Box, and Steve Bartman. Try and think of any person with zero affiliation to organized baseball who had a bigger impact, at least culturally. With the exception of Jack Norworth, who wrote Take Me Out to the Ball Game, and maybe the Gamblers of the early 20th century, Bartman was by far the most influential outsider. One mishap, one admitted mistake, would spin the baseball world into a tizzy. Fan interferences happen all the time to every team, some to their benefit and others not. But this particular incident, because it was the playoffs and because it was the Cubs and because the Marlins would end up scoring 8 runs that inning, forces us to remember Steve Bartman. His oval face, his glasses, his green turtleneck, and of course, those headphones. In 1956 and 57, the physicist Hugh Everett started publishing his theories that would later come to be known as the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. I'm probably committing nerd heresy by trying to explain this, but just hear me out. You woke up this morning. Maybe the first thing you did was take a shower. Great. But what if the first thing that you did was start a pot of coffee? You didn't do it, but you could have. And the mere fact that you could have, in the terms of the many worlds interpretation, means that on some universe, you did. There's a parallel universe that exists for every possibility of every decision you and anyone that's ever existed has made. Now, instead of you and your coffee, imagine this applied to Steve Bartman. Imagine he had stayed in his seat, or stayed home that day, or the ball drifted back into play more so Moises Alou had an easy catch. Or maybe Luis Castillo simply swung and missed on the pitch from Mark Pryor. There are a lot of different possibilities. And almost all of them reside in a world where we'll never hear the name Steve Bartman. Maybe the Cubs end up winning the game, maybe not. Maybe the curse of the Billy Goat is lifted, maybe not. But nonetheless, Steve Bartman does not exist to any more people than knew him when that game started. He's just a guy. A fan. Theories are all well and good, but the fact of our reality is that Steve Bartman is who he is because he did what he did. I like to ponder the theoretical physics of the Bartman incident, but I also really love that no one has heard from him. The Son of Sam rule states that people who commit crimes cannot profit from the sale of their story to a publisher or a movie studio. Though some Cubs fans may disagree, Bartman committed no crime. And yet, we never heard his story. He did release a statement, quote, "There are few words to describe how awful I feel and what I have experienced within these last 24 hours. I've been a Cub fan all my life and fully understand the relationship between my actions and the outcome of the game. I had my eyes glued on the approaching ball the entire time and was so caught up in the moment that I did not even see Moises Alou, much less that he may have had a play. Had I thought for one second that the ball was playable or I had seen Alou approaching, I would have done whatever I could to get out of the way and give Alou a chance to make the catch. To Moises Alou, the Chicago Cubs organization, Ron Santo, Ernie Banks, and Cub fans everywhere, I am truly sorry from the bottom of this Cubs fan's broken heart. I ask that Cub fans everywhere redirect the negative energy that has been vented toward my family, my friends, and myself into the usual positive support for our beloved team on their way to being National League champs." End quote. For all intents and purposes, that's the last we heard of Bartman. He never talked to a reporter, never went on TV, never published his side of the story. And that's what draws me to him so much more. Yes, he could have made a bunch of money in a movie deal or TV appearances after the hate had died down a bit. Especially now, 10 years later, I doubt Steve Bartman's life or well-being would be in danger if he decided to show his face. But he doesn't. He could be rich, but he intends to stay out of the spotlight. Because deep down, he is truly sorry. When I visited Wrigley, lots of people weren't paying attention during the game. They were on their cell phones, or flirting with someone, or getting up in the middle of an at-bat to buy a hot dog. Sorry, that still bothers me. I don't care about those fans. I care about the ones who can recognize the Ron Santo statue outside the stadium without even reading the plaque. The ones who know what Let's Play 2 means. The diehards. For them, being a Cubs fan is more than just a hobby or an inclination, it's a job. It's hard work to care about a team that gives so little back to you for so long. It's a grind. The suffering is what you sign up for. Many people have died without it ever paying off. Some are still holding on, hoping that their team will do good by them before they shuffle off this mortal coil. And those temporary actions may have proven otherwise. I think Steve Bartman is one of those fans. In one of those other universes, Bartman got to see the Cubs win the whole thing. He's happy. He has a picture of him at the game on a mantle somewhere next to the framed front page of the Tribune. That Steve Bartman is part of the winning culture. Our Steve Bartman is part of the losing culture. And he knows it. And that's why he's staying quiet. And that's why Steve Bartman is the MVP of my heart. That's it for this episode. Stealing Home is produced and hosted by David Temple. Hey, that's me. You can get more information on the show by going to stealinghome.org, where you can find show notes for every episode that I've posted so far. You can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/stealinghomeradio and on Twitter at stealinghomeorg. That's it for me. I'm David Temple. We'll see you next time on Stealing Home.